First films, the beginnings of the left-brain, right-brain distinction. Ideas for things we should study kept rolling in. In the beginning, we took them on, or at least initiated them, quickly and rather easily. While Sperry was unquestionably interested in the studies, they had not yet captured his full attention. As I already mentioned, he was extremely busy with this other exceptional project. Like a financier, he had placed a bet on a small company, of which I was the chief operating officer, and he was waiting for enduring returns. He kept closely involved with almost daily meetings with me, but he had a way of keeping a distance as well. As Bogan wrote in his autobiography, then a lot of things came after that. In the beginning, Sperry was not that interested. He just thought he would let me and Gazzaniga do it, but it became apparent to Sperry after the second patient that anything you could do with a monkey, you could do a lot faster with human beings. He got a lot more interested. Back east, Norm Geschwind complained a bit about his original observations not receiving instant recognition beyond the local Boston buzz. He wrote, "As a reflection of this lack of interest, it is interesting to observe that when Edith Kaplan and I described the first modern patient with the syndrome of the corpus callosum, the paper was rejected by the New England Journal of Medicine without any comment. The journal Neurology was interested, however, and accepted it. It is not unusual for big discoveries not to be recognized as such. Paul Lauterbur's first attempt at publishing his work that led to the development of MRI, magnetic resonance image, was rejected by the journal Nature. He went on to win the 2003 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for it. He later quipped, "You could write the entire history of science in the last 50 years in terms of papers rejected by science or nature." I've come to realize that, for a short while, the enthusiasms of discovery can be quite local to the person doing the work. The world is a busy place, and everyone is vested in what they are doing. Grabbing their attention away from their current passions is a process. David Primack, one of the world's most talented psychologists, once observed that after he published his paper in Science, groundbreaking studies that led up to his theory of motivation, what later became called the Primack Principle, he thought it would all be easy from there. He remarked to me, "Little did I know I would spend the next 10 years hitting the road to sell it at every departmental colloquium I could find." Sperry's interest did indeed come around. I would be left with no doubt about that after a talk I was asked to give to the biology department, a sort of sounding board seminar for graduate students. When I gave the talk, I had been working on the split brain project for at least 2 years, and was deeply into all aspects of the testing program. But it was the films I showed that were the showstoppers. From the beginning, I had been intent on establishing a film record of the experiments. In 1962, video cameras did not exist. It was all film, 16mm film to be exact, with clunky cameras. That found me making friends with the people at Alvin's Camera Shop on Lake Street in Pasadena. Filming is not an easy enterprise. At the beginning, I didn't know anything about filming, about lighting, f-stops, focus, depth of field, or keeping the object to be filmed in view. Most of all, I didn't have any idea how much a Bolex camera cost. The people at Alvin's Camera Shop taught me everything. They began by fixing me up with a hand-cranked Bolex 16 and a tripod. I started out easily enough. One of the questions that kept coming up whenever anybody heard about the work was, how are the patients affected in everyday life? So off I went to film patients doing everyday activities. One of the patients, N.G., lived in West Covina, about 30 minutes from Caltech, and her husband worked at a Ford factory. They lived quite well and had a lovely swimming pool in their backyard. One day I went out to see her and set up the camera by the pool. N.G. gladly swam a couple of laps. I then set up a shot of her sitting down on her couch and reading a newspaper, just like anybody else. To get more sophisticated than this required another addition to the camera. You could attach a small motor that allowed you to film remotely. Thus, I could set the camera up on a tripod, direct it toward an aspect of the experiment, and control the camera while I was doing whatever had to be done in the experiment. These films proved quite dramatic, and of poor quality. I was definitely not an ace cameraman. What to do? My good fortune was that I had come to know Baron Woolman, a fantastic young photographer and a future founder of Rolling Stone. He somehow had become totally fascinated with the research, another in the growing list of non-scientists I was meeting who were interested in science, and was willing to lend me a hand. I asked if he would mind driving down to Downey with me to film WJ doing a simple task on a tabletop. Barron didn't mind, and came along. That film has become one of the benchmark representations of split-brain research. The film was clear and crisp. In it, WJ was first requested to arrange a set of blocks that were part of the Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale Test Bank. These were four blocks, each colored differently on their six sides. The patient was shown a card with one of many possible patterns on it and was asked to simply arrange the blocks to match the pattern, commonly called the COSE blocks. For reasons that are still not completely clear, the human right cerebral hemisphere is specialized for the kind of visual motor function that enables someone to do this task. This would predict that the left hand, which gains its motor control from the right hemisphere, would be superior at doing this task. That is exactly what happened and is shown in the film. Lickety-split, the left hand assembles the blocks directly. The next scene shows the right hand trying to do the same task. The right hand gains its control from the left hemisphere, the one with language and speech. Yet when it tried to assemble the four blocks to match the very same picture, it couldn't do it. It couldn't even get the overall organization of how the blocks should be positioned in a 2x2 square. It just as often would arrange them in a 3+1 shape. It was amazing. And as the right hand was trying and failing, suddenly the more competent left hand would try to intervene. This was such a common occurrence that we had to have WJ sit on his interfering left hand when the right hand was trying to do something. Finally, we ran a trial where we left both hands free to try to solve the problem. In that one sequence, a much larger picture of what split-brain research was ultimately going to teach us was revealed. In brief, one hand tried to undo the accomplishments of the other. The left hand would make a move to get things correct, and the right hand would undo the gain. It looked like two separate mental systems were struggling for their view of the world. It was dramatic, to say the least. The entire COSE block test grew out of two earlier efforts. First, there was clear evidence from earlier neurological studies that right hemisphere lesions impaired the ability to draw a picture with a three-dimensional perspective, such as drawing a cube. We first did this test very early on, and it was clearly the case with WJ. The left hand could draw a respectable cube. The right hand could not. Meanwhile, Bogan kept trying to convince us to do standard neuropsychological testing. Sperry and I didn't see the point, but to his credit, Joe pursued the matter and writes about it convincingly. After Bill had recovered from his surgical ordeal and was feeling better, he was eager to participate in some laboratory experiments. After some months, a helpful social worker got in touch with a psychologist who occasionally tested clinic patients. She arranged some funding and he agreed to meet. He seemed to me not only quite elderly, but actually quite infirm. I explained the patient to the psychologist and how interesting he was. I asked him, "Do you give the standard tests?" "Oh, yes, the Wechsler." I didn't know much about the test, and neither did Mike, and he reluctantly agreed after some argumentation. Old Daddy Edwards, as I learned he was sometimes called around the hospital, acceded to our request. He sat across a card table, part of his equipment, from Bill. Mike and I sat on the other two sides watching. The testing went along for an hour or so, somewhat tediously from our point of view, until Dr. Edwards pulled out the block design subtest. Bill pushed the blocks around somewhat ineffectually. Meanwhile, Edwards was timing in his usual fashion and ended up with a zero score. I suggested that Bill use one hand at a time. Dr. Edwards objected because it was customary for subjects to use both hands. However, he was persuaded to try this momentarily, so he asked Bill to use only his right hand while sitting on his left hand. He had considerable success. Mike and I looked at each other as if we had caught a glimpse of the Holy Grail. "Now try it with just your left hand," I asked. He was quite successful. "Now try the next pattern." With his left hand, he did the next one quite quickly. "No," Edward said. "He is supposed to use both hands." It was getting a little tense, because he insisted on doing it the standard way, and we were anxious to further pursue our grail. Dr. Edwards quietly prevailed, and he finished the tests. We thanked him, and he replied, "Yes, it was interesting. We should test 20 or 30 more of these epileptic patients with various lesions." So this fumbling with the two hands seemed to be an example of what Acolytis called diagnostic dyspraxia, which we had subsequently termed inter-manual conflict. We realized Edwards was in the dark as to what had happened and what sort of patient Bill was or why we were so wreathed in smiles. My next move was to borrow a set of these Wexler blocks. One needed a license to buy them, and then I eventually obtained a set of the Coe's colored blocks. We retested Bill, and sure enough, he had the same discrepancy between the left hand doing well and the right hand doing poorly, and this persisted for at least 2 years. When we showed the data to Sperry, he commented in his usual soft, skeptical way, "Well, I guess you boys have got that fellow pretty well trained by now." It was true that not all patients showed this discrepancy. The second patient did not show this discrepancy, being actually rather poor at the test with either hand. However, some patients definitely did show the discrepancy. Thankfully, in the late 1960s, soon after my Caltech days, the black-and-white reel-to-reel video cameras arrived. Combined with the recording unit, they were originally large and clunky, even though they enabled the video recording of experiments. Still, at least in the early days of video, something about film had video beat by a long shot. A few years later, when I moved to the State University of New York, Stony Brook, my entire startup package went to purchasing a Beaulieu News 16, a 16mm camera that recorded sound on the film. The silent movie era was over. We could actually hear what patients said in response to questions and queries of various sorts. I hauled that camera around in its fancy, huge aluminum case for years, taking it to Paris and other places, feeling quite macho while doing so. Many years later, it had become a burden to maintain and use, and it slipped off the inventory. A talented Dartmouth undergraduate was graduating and leaving for a life in documentary filmmaking in Brooklyn. I had it tuned up and gave it to him. It lives somewhere. As I've said, Sperry was about to become fully engaged. At my coming-out seminar, I had put together a 15-minute film of the patients doing their various things. First, I showed them in everyday life situations looking utterly normal in all ways. Next were various scenes of patients showing the disconnection effects, including not being able to speak about visual information projected into the left visual field. More important, I then showed scenes where that left field information could nonetheless be acted upon with the left hand by finding a matching object from a group of objects. Finally, the film wound up with a segment of WJ doing the block test I described. It was, to say the least, riveting, a showstopper. Everybody said so. That was a great day. I would describe the next day differently. It was tough. Sperry asked me to come to his office, and within minutes the grilling started. He challenged every finding as if he had not been following them closely, even though we had spoken for hours upon hours after each testing session, many of which he had attended. He went at it for a couple of hours. I was in shock. I didn't realize for some time that he was doing the right thing. The 15-minute film really made the studies come to life, and he knew this was going to be a big deal. He wanted to make absolutely sure all the tests were done correctly. He had placed his bet and given his complete and unwavering support early on. Now he was going to really make sure the work was unassailable. He was doing his job, and I was still learning how it all worked. In the background was the ever-present Caltech culture, a culture that was all about inquiry. Richard Feynman, for example, had a way of popping into graduate students' offices and asking them what they were doing. One day I was working away when the door opened up and there were Feynman's crystal blue eyes. He asked, "So what are you doing?" I was deeply involved, at that point, with primate testing, an enterprise that was intense and costly. Building training devices for each monkey was getting expensive, and the overall data collection and analysis was clumsy. And there was the problem of monkey virus B, a deadly disease that could be communicated to humans by a monkey bite. So when Feynman asked me the question, I had a ready answer. "Well," I said, "I'm trying to build a device that we could implant in each monkey that would send out a radio signal identifying him. Then we could put all the monkeys in one big cage, have a testing platform at the end of the cage, and when the monkey hopped up to play the game, a computer would recognize which animal it was and keep the response data sorted out." Or something like that. Feynman furrowed his brow and said, "I have a simpler system. Put the monkeys on a differential diet, so each weighs a different amount. When they get on the testing platform, let a scale detect which monkey it is by weight and use that as a way to keep track of the data. No fancy radio transmitters and no implant surgeries." He smiled, winked, and got up and left. I was stunned, but soon got back to work. A few minutes later, Sperry walked into the lab, as he often did. I told him the story, we chit-chatted a bit, and he left. About 30 minutes later, Sperry came back. He said, "It won't work." Puzzled, I asked, "What won't work?" "Feynman's idea," he answered. "The animals will cheat and won't weigh in properly. They will grab the cage bar when they swing in to work." As Sperry left, I thought once again that I worked at the greatest place on earth, brimming with smarts and bristling with competition. Wait, how does sensory-motor integration work? Seeing anyone study now, with the knowledge under my belt that I have gained from hundreds of subsequent studies examining dozens of issues, puts me in mind of several brain mechanisms at work during a given test. During those early days, however, none of those mechanisms had been worked out. As Bogan pointed out, the other widely studied patients of the California series did not show the clear results on the block design test that WJ revealed. What was up with that? What could possibly explain the individual variation of capacity seen in several patients? Individual variation always offers an opportunity to dig deeper into mechanisms, so it was back to work for me. In the lab at the time, everyone is fascinated with the problem of sensory-motor integration in cats, monkeys, and humans. We knew that each of the disconnected hemispheres best controlled the opposite arm and hand. Colvin Trevarthen, a postdoctoral student at the time, who had also done his thesis work at Caltech, was carrying out a series of very clever experiments, showing that in monkeys, use of one arm or hand responding on a task meant the opposite hemisphere would learn the problem. The ipsilateral, same-side hemisphere, even though it had equal access to the information, did not learn. Switch the hand that was responding to the task, however, and quickly enough learning took place in the previously oblivious hemisphere. So, each hemisphere is really good at controlling the opposite arm or hand. That made tremendous sense with the underlying anatomy. The puzzle was, how did a hemisphere control the ipsilateral hand, which some patients seemed able to do? In other words, how did a left hemisphere control the left hand? While WJ's individual hemispheres had little problem controlling the contralateral arm and hand, they were remarkably unable to control an ipsilateral arm and hand. This is quite a dramatic situation. Many of the original split-brain stories about two minds being in our skulls instead of one came from that clear linkage between each hemisphere and its contralateral arm. The film emphasized this basic finding, which was immediately evident to anyone testing the patient. As more patients were added to the study pool, however, many began to show good control over the ipsilateral arm as well as the contralateral arm. Yet even when there was good control of the ipsilateral arm, good control over movements of the ipsilateral hand seemed to elude the patients. How did all of this work? It finally became apparent to us why all the patients did not show the same block design phenomenon as WJ, who was uniquely skilled with his left hand. Some of the patients had more control over their ipsilateral hands than did others. It usually took them a little time after surgery to learn how to control the ipsilateral hand, but most of them got really good at it. That meant that a hemisphere, specialized for a kind of processing that could be revealed by, say, arranging blocks, could, after it learned to control the ipsilateral hand, do it with either hand. Thus we could not tell which hemisphere was controlling the movements of the hands. This dual control made it exceedingly tricky to evaluate the special abilities of the left and right brains. That most of the patients eventually gained control of their ipsilateral arm was evident. It was true for the original series of patients in California, and also for the East Coast patients tested later. It took several of us a great deal of research to figure out how. The problem has fascinated everybody. Myers and Sperry studied it in the cat, and Trevarthen studied it in the monkey. Everyone took different pieces of the puzzle. I went after a very simple question. How could a monkey, with one hemisphere viewing the world, pick up a grape with the ipsilateral hand? The answer would be revealing. Again, the overall puzzle was, why, when it came to carrying out goal-directed behavior, did animals with their brains divided and sometimes far more extensively disconnected than was ever done in humans always seem like they were behaving in an integrated way? How, for example, was the left hemisphere of a deeply split rhesus monkey, a hemisphere disconnection that extended deep into the brain, down even into the pons, able to control its ipsilateral left hand. Footnote: the pons is part of the brainstem. Part of our problem was that we had made an assumption. Our assumption, to which we were all so committed, was that voluntary motor control originated from a central command center that had to directly connect to particular peripheral muscles. Because of that assumption, what we observed at first made no sense to us. We had been duped by our own false idea. And as we shed the assumptions, the workings of the brain began to look very different from what we had assumed. The notion that there is an eye, or a command central, in the brain was an illusion. I know this is hard to swallow, which is the very reason it took us so long to figure out. There is no one point where the director lives. No homunculus calling the shots. Dozens of studies finally revealed the reality. The animals were engaged in self-cueing. There was no command central. One hemisphere was reading the cues set up by the other to produce an integrated, effective behavioral outcome. Suddenly, our whole view of how the brain might coordinate its parts was undergoing what amounted to a paradigm shift. In order to uncover this strategy, we took high-speed films of split-brain monkeys, each with one eye closed, reaching for objects such as grapes. In these animals, the optic chiasm was also divided, which meant that information presented to one eye went only to the ipsilateral hemisphere. So if we occluded the right eye, and I did this by various means, including a specially designed contact lens, only the left hemisphere could see. Then we filmed how well the two hands retrieved grapes presented to the animal at the end of a wand. With visual information now restricted to the left hemisphere, the right hand, which it controlled, was quick and deliberate in retrieving the much-desired grapes. As the hand moved to grasp the grape, the posture of the hand properly formed in anticipation of retrieving the morsel of food. When the animal, his vision still limited to the left hemisphere, tried to use the left hand, however, a different strategy was evident. Cueing was active at many levels. First, the monkey would orient its entire body toward the object. The left seeing hemisphere had control over gross body posture and orientation. It could easily position the entire body in the correct orientation toward the desired point in space occupied by the grapes. As a consequence, through proprioceptive feedback mechanisms, which provide motion and position feedback from tendons and joints, the right hemisphere now knew in a general sort of way where the object was located. Then the left arm would reach out in the general direction of the object. The left hemisphere could initiate left arm movements by signaling, using a body movement to the right hemisphere to go. As a result, the right hemisphere commanded the left hand to start off in the appropriate direction, which it now knew because of the proprioceptive feedback from the arm. In short, the right hemisphere knew roughly where the object was. Here was the fascinating part. The left hand remained limp rather than getting ready to grasp the object, because its controlling hemisphere had no idea what the object was. The right hemisphere couldn't actually see it, and the left could not control the distal digits of the left hand. As a result, the hand always looked ill-posed for actually grasping the grape. Until the grand finale. Eventually, the hand bumped into the grape. At that moment, the somatosensory and motor systems of the right hemisphere were cued and clicked in. The left hand snapped to, formed the correct posture, and grasped the grape. It's a lot like when we stick our hand into a dark drawer to pull something out. As soon as we feel it, we know how to grab it. So understanding why we did not see the right hemispheric specialization for block design in all the patients is not only comprehensible, but to be expected. WJ had additional brain damage other than the colossal brain damage that prevented the ipsilateral sensory motor system with its feedback mechanisms from working well. The other patients were more intact neurologically, and they quickly learned how to work the system. Years later, when I began to study the East Coast series of cases, we saw how immediately after surgery there was poor ipsilateral control of the arm and hand, which later improved after the hemispheres had learned how to cue each other. It is impossible to keep at a single project 24/7, whereas it is fairly easy to be highly involved with life 24/7. The human split-brain work kept me busy, but not all the time. I had other research projects going, partly because it was possible that the human work would soon wrap up. Then what? While WJ was the inaugural case for launching the surgically sectioned split-brain era, it later turned out that he was not the most interesting case. After a while, we realized that he had quite limited functioning from his right hemisphere. The original studies on WJ, however, did answer basic questions about disconnection effects. We showed that visual information presented to one hemisphere didn't transfer to the other. We explained the more complicated picture of the somatosensory system, and we worked out the capacity and limits of a brain's ability to control the arms and hands. Finally, we were able to show how one hemisphere was superior to the other at carrying out three-dimensional reconstructions, the block design test. And, as I say, we did that all rather quickly. While that work was getting done, we also became interested in exploring the mental capacity of the non-speaking right hemisphere and finding out what else it could do. Did it have any language at all? Could it solve problems? Could it learn simple games? For more than 2 years, we pushed and pushed on these issues. It turned out that WJ's right hemisphere had only rudimentary cognitive abilities. While his right hemisphere could do what is called a simple match-to-sample test, its success on more complicated tasks was only as frequent as would occur by chance. So when we flashed a picture of a triangle to the right hemisphere, it could point to a picture of a triangle from a set of many possibilities. If we flashed a word of an object like apple or anything else, however, the right hemisphere was at sea. A simple capacity to match objects showed that it was functioning independently, but it wasn't functioning at a high level that involved any kind of language. The linguistic potential of the right hemisphere only became evident as more cases came along. So there we were. We knew that the cognitive capacities of WJ's right hemisphere were limited. Before the next cases, NG and LB, came along, everyone got involved with other projects. We were at a point in the overall program where we all remained excited about our discoveries, but were asking ourselves how long it would go on. At that time, we had no idea how rich split-brain research would become when more cases were added to the research pool. The new cases would prove to be game-changers in an exciting way. But all of that was to come later. From Sperry's perspective, while we had an exciting finding, he wasn't about to relinquish his long-standing commitment to the field of developmental neurobiology. As Bogan pointed out, it was no wonder he was a bit circumspect in the beginning. Still, what do you do in your spare time? Well, in those days, you easily did more research. Money wasn't an issue. Time was there if you made it, and certainly the questions were there, being generated in large part by the successful human work. After studying WJ, one of the first questions I had was, were memories for events in a monkey's life laid down doubly, one in each hemisphere? Language-based memories in WJ were clearly present in only the left brain. How would a monkey that had learned various visual discriminations, while normal, respond to querying each hemisphere for that knowledge after it had undergone split-brain surgery? And how would I run those experiments? While Sperry's laboratory was a rich community of personalities, it was also a very cooperative community. To get me going, Trevarthen and Sperry did the surgeries. Lois Bird, Sperry's lab technician, helped me learn how to train monkeys. Reggie, in the shop, taught me how to build testing devices, even though he did most of the work. And my best friend at Caltech, Charles Hamilton, an advanced graduate student, taught me everything else. So they launched me on a stint of primate research of one kind or another for more than 15 years, all while I continued the human work. Working with animals, especially monkeys, is a demanding emotional experience. While monkeys can be aggressive and nasty, they usually aren't. We cared deeply for the animals, and following a surgery would stay with them until they recovered. We did all of this naturally and without instruction. But in many labs, cruelty was built into the demands of the research. There has been a deep cultural shift since then in how animals are thought of, reflected now in lab practices. Today, animal research is run by professionals and is more carefully monitored than the monitoring that goes on in some human clinics. The results of the experiment, asking whether the same memory was stored in both hemispheres, were clean and clear. Monkeys that were taught a visual problem appeared to keep only one copy of the memory. Cats, however, appeared to keep two copies, one in each hemisphere. Our testing with WJ showed that there wasn't any clear indication that the right hemisphere had copies of the memories that were associated with hearing or reading language, memories which the left hemisphere clearly possessed. Yet we knew that both hemispheres could recognize an object, even if naming it was beyond the right hemisphere's abilities. At one level, it appeared that the monkeys and humans were similar. But on another level, humans and cats were similar. Of course, the problem got more complicated as more experiments rolled in. The puzzle of where memories are stored is alive and well after all these years. In that original study with monkeys, we also showed that the hemisphere that possessed the memories varied. Sometimes it was the left hemisphere, and sometimes it was the right. This suggested that there was not an underlying specialization in the brain responsible for the unilateral memory traces seen in humans. Some patients seemed to have bilateral language capacity, while many more did not. Over the years, and as the human split-brain cases added up, the amount of human variation was also notable. How this works is still a mystery. The Nobel Prize. It is no secret that Roger Sperry and I had some difficulties later in my career. As the years rolled by, I chose to continue the split-brain approach in my research and published accordingly. Scientists frequently switch their approach and what they study, and it aggravated him that I didn't. We had exchanged some unsettling correspondence, both in the early 1970s and mid-1980s. While sharing credit was not his strong suit, it also should be no secret that I never had anything but the highest regard for him. When he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1981 for split-brain work, it was well deserved. Science magazine asked me to write an appreciation for him, which I did with enthusiasm. I much prefer to have this statement be the public record of my thoughts about him than the sometimes rather ghoulish and misleading letters I received indicate. Chapter 3. Searching for the Brain's Morse Code. For every minute you are angry, you lose 60 seconds of happiness. Ralph Waldo Emerson. My views changed over time. The first two reports by Joe Boken, Roger Sperry, and myself were mainly about WJ. Single cases are always interesting but hardly definitive. As more cases came under study, it was clear that while what we'd learned from WJ set the stage for split-brain study in humans, it would not define what could be learned. The simple, straightforward picture at the start was energizing but far from complete. In fact, 50 years later, we are still far from completely understanding the full neural and psychological consequences of severing the major neural cable in the brain connecting the two half-brains. While colossal surgery for epilepsy has always been done infrequently, it has become even less frequent with the advent of other surgical strategies and better pharmacologic interventions. Joe used to say all the time that science advances first by a major finding being unearthed, then years of other stuff being piled on top of it, smothering it with details that are distracting. From that perspective, the newer cases were complicating. For example, as I mentioned in the last chapter, they quickly revealed that one hemisphere could control both arms but not both hands. We then went on to find that because each hemisphere could control both arms, a touch to either side of the torso could be located and pointed to by either hand. This finding made it seem that sensory information from both sides of the torso projected equally to both hemispheres, which we would then find was not the case. We also observed that the right hemispheres could sometimes seem extremely smart and sometimes even uniquely smart, capable of some nonverbal skills. In short, a much more interactive and dynamic mental system seemed present, even though the interactions were being controlled by two utterly private and disconnected cognitive systems. We slowly began to realize that it was not going to be easy to understand whether we were examining the separate psychological processes of one isolated and disconnected half-brain or being duped by the other half. All of this was happening a couple of years into the Caltech testing program, as still more cases were added for study in Los Angeles and eventually from different surgical centers throughout the country. The issue of the two hemispheres continuously interacting with one another in complex ways became ever more evident. In the mid-1970s, the first new patients from the East Coast broadened our basic understanding even more. That development, however, was almost 10 years off. As the mid-1960s approached, I knew at some point I had to leave the nest. It was an unsettling thought, as Caltech remained my scientific heaven. For a long time, I simply ignored that reality and went about my business. My last couple of years in Pasadena were rich, and I was recently reminded how rich when I came across the series of films I had made. Seeing those films, along with a later video of Case DR, one of our East Coast patients, triggered fond memories of identifying basic mechanisms in both series of patients. One of those basic mechanisms had to do with emotions. Emotions color our cognitive states almost moment to moment. More primitive subcortical parts of the brain located below the callosum are heavily involved in the management of emotions, and many of those structures have interhemispheric connections. Could it be that emotions experienced by one hemisphere could be detected by or have influence on the opposite hemisphere? Those questions began to form as we started to see the differences between WJ and the second Caltech case, NG. While studying NG, we began to suspect that each hemisphere wanted to monitor the other. NG could control either arm from one hemisphere. We saw an instance in which one hemisphere, by initiating just the slightest head movement, could cue the other hemisphere with a solution to a task we had requested of the first. In a sense, the two hemispheres were cheating like two kids in a classroom. Once we realized what was going on, the findings all made sense. Imagine being tightly yoked to someone, even though each of you remains a completely independent person, just like highly competent tango dancers. Any slight movement of the head by one gives cues to the partner of exactly what to do and when to do it. Of course, it should work that way. In our studies, this meant that with practice, the patients were going to become better and better at self-cueing. Brain cueing is everywhere. All of this subtle communication between the surgically separated hemispheres was clearly evident in our cognitive testing. We dubbed it cross-cueing. Modular or separate systems cueing each other in order to generate purposeful and integrated behavioral outcomes seemed to be everywhere. We detected this early on in both the animal and human split-brain work at Caltech, and saw it occur time and again when testing our patients over the next 50 years. In one of the first observations, I was in the process of seeing if patients who spoke only out of the left hemisphere could name simple colored lights shown to both visual fields. In the early days, we were always concerned with whether or not basic visual information could transfer over from the right hemisphere and be described by the left hemisphere, perhaps via intact subcortical pathways. During one such study, the patient, NG, displayed our newly discovered self-cueing strategy. The test was as follows. If any colored light came on in the right visual field, which projected to the left-speaking brain, then there was no hesitancy. It was quickly named correctly. When a light came on in the left field, however, projected to the right brain, matters changed, though it wasn't obvious right away. If we flashed the color green to the right hemisphere, and NG spoke the word green, and the color had been green, the patient said nothing else, and we got ready for the next trial. At that point in the test, we did not know if the information about the light had somehow transferred over to the left hemisphere, if the left hemisphere was simply guessing, or if the right hemisphere was actually speaking. The telltale trials were when the right hemisphere saw a particular color, say, red, and NG said the wrong color, say, green. After a few flat-out mistakes, the patient started stating the correct color every time. Somehow she had learned a strategy that made it appear that the left hemisphere could name something only the right hemisphere had seen. She would start to say green, but then she would stop, and then guess correctly by saying red. What was happening was the left hemisphere was doing the talking, and the disconnected right hemisphere was hearing the green being uttered by the guessing left hemisphere. The right hemisphere somehow stopped the speech emanating from the left brain by giving some kind of cue, such as nodding the head or shrugging the shoulders. The wily left hemisphere would pick up on the cue, which it had figured out during the first erroneous trials, and would change its response to the only other color. All of this happened in the flash of an eye. I wanted to look into the self-cueing strategy more deeply. In a sense, this kind of cueing was taking place outside the brain. The patients were learning the equivalent of tango dance strategies. That is, one side of the body tapped the other to get communication going between the two halves of the brain. It could look like the two separate brains were unified by internal connections and communication, but in reality, it was external signals providing the communication that united the two. We also began to wonder if there was cueing actually going on within the brain. After all, the surgery only disconnected the cognitive and sensory systems housed in the cortex. There were still dozens of ways one side could connect with the other in complex, albeit more indirect ways, within the intact subcortical pathways of the brain. And, as I just mentioned, we wondered about the more ethereal aspects of mental life, such as emotions. It seemed as though monkey experiments could get at the emotion question. So in Caltech style, we just did it. This required building more special testing devices, more animals, and more honing of my own surgical skills. Surgical procedures were taken very seriously and carefully planned. We all trained ourselves, first by attending surgeries performed by seasoned members of the lab. I was lucky for the highly skilled Giovanni Berlucci, visiting from Pisa, Italy, let me sit in on his surgeries. Sperry was also a fantastic surgeon. Once when I was in the surgical room, watching him at a delicate point in the surgery, he looked intently into the operating microscope and softly said, "I can't seem to see the anterior commissure." I leaned forward to better hear him, and in doing so jarred the table, to which he calmly said, "Oh, there it is, always unflappable." To carry out this experiment, the monkeys, once they had recovered from surgery, were outfitted with goggles equipped with one red and one blue lens. The colored light filters allowed different visual images to be projected to the separated hemispheres. We wanted to know what would happen to the work pattern of one hemisphere if the other were suddenly exposed to an emotionally powerful stimulus, such as a snake. Would the emotionally provoked half-brain dominate or subcortically influence the half-brain that was engaged in the simple and emotionally neutral task of visual learning? The answer was clear. The animals jumped back. The hemisphere that had seen the emotional stimulus, the snake, and experienced the emotion, fear, cued the rest of the animal. Something is wrong. With that gross and unmistakable cue, the animal became agitated and ceased working on the discrimination task and would not return to work either. Cross-cueing of a kind was evident once again. In this instance, it appeared that one separate and distinct mental system could be agitated and in that agitation not let the other mental system function in its normal way. The idea crept into our heads that the mind was a collection of mental systems, not just one. At the time, this was a new and important idea. It was absolutely crucial to the understanding of why the split-brain monkeys, as well as the patients, behaved as they did. Testing different theories on both animals and humans continued. In the later 1960s, years after we both had left Caltech, Steve Hilliard and I were collaborating on a study. We were trying to figure out the language capacity of the third Caltech patient, LB, when we spotted another variant of cross-cueing. We set up an easy test for the patient. All he had to do was name the number 1 through 9 that was flashed either to the left or the right visual field. Normally, we would expect the right visual field stimuli to be named quickly. Thus, if a 1, or 4, or 7 flashed up in random order, the patient's left-speaking hemisphere would respond correctly. It did. Each number was named with about the same reaction time. What initially surprised us, however, was that the right hemisphere seemed to be naming all the numbers, too. What was going on? Was this our first patient to show transfer of information between the hemispheres? Alternatively, was this a right hemisphere that could speak? This possibility is always there and must always be investigated. Or was the right hemisphere somehow cueing the left hemisphere again? Hilliard plotted out the reaction times for each response, and the strategy LB was using became apparent. All the numbers flashed to the left hemisphere were named rapidly in about the same amount of time. When the same random list of numbers was presented to the right hemisphere, however, 1 was reacted to more quickly than 2, which was reacted to more quickly than 3, which in turn was reacted to more quickly than 4, and so on all the way up to 9. Another cross-cueing strategy revealed. The left-speaking hemisphere started counting, using some somatic cueing systems, such as a slight head bob, which the right hemisphere could sense. When the number of bobs hit the number that was presented to the right hemisphere sent a somatic stop signal that the left hemisphere could sense. At this point, the left knew that must have been the number that was flashed and said it, not the right. Unbelievable. Trying to outfox this cross-cueing system, we ran another series of trials. This time, the patient was required to respond immediately. While the left hemisphere continued to respond correctly and quickly, the right hemisphere score dropped to chance. The brain was shifting strategies to accomplish the same goal. The power of the bedside exam. Case D.R. When studying neurologically disrupted patients, certain general principles emerge. For example, the patients nearly always strive to complete a goal that has been set by their examiner. One might think and hope they are solving a task in a particular way, even when in fact they are solving it in another. The challenge is to identify the way they are solving it. When you do, underlying mechanisms are revealed that are frequently surprising. When sorting through my hundreds of hours of videotapes of patients, I recently came across a particularly vivid example, which revealed how cueing can occur when a patient is simply trying to copy a gesture made by one hand with the opposite hand. This was case DR, a split-brain patient from the Dartmouth series of cases. DR was also a college graduate and an accountant. After spending time in South America, she had moved to New England. Along the way, she had become a Trekkie. She had all the Star Trek episodes recorded, and also owned a rather expensive model of the Enterprise. After her surgery, she showed all the standard disconnection phenomena. Visual information did not transfer between the hemispheres, nor did tactile information. Her left hemisphere was dominant for language and speech. Her right hemisphere functioned at a lower cognitive level, being able only to recognize pictures but not to read. We wanted to examine her motor control capacity. With her eyes wide open, I asked her to hold out her two hands, fists closed. That was the starting position for each subsequent command. I then asked her to make the hitchhiker sign with her right hand. She did so instantly. I then asked her to do the same thing with the left hand. She also did that quickly. I then asked her to make the A-OK sign with her right hand. Again, she did so quickly. When asked to do it with her left hand, after a slight hesitation, she had no problem. Here is where learning begins for the examiner when testing neurologic patients. One has to make sure that the task a patient is trying to complete for you is being done the way you imagined it would be done. In this case, I knew, of course, that the patient had undergone split-brain surgery. By the time we worked with her in the 1980s, I knew that there was tremendous variation on how well a disconnected hemisphere could control the ipsilateral hand. Of course, there never was a problem controlling the contralateral hand, as both the sensory and motor systems needed for such activity were all represented in the same hemisphere. Controlling the ipsilateral hand, however, was a very different story. How did her dominant left hemisphere, which had to interpret my spoken command messages, send them over to the motor systems in her right hemisphere, which controls her left hand? Those motor control systems for the left hand were unquestionably managed by her disconnected right hemisphere. How was information presented to one hemisphere being integrated for use in the opposite disconnected half-brain? Recall that case WJ was remarkably unable to control an ipsilateral arm and hand, while having little problem controlling the contralateral arm and hand from a particular hemisphere. This was quite a dramatic situation. As I said earlier, many of the original split-brain stories about two minds being present in our skulls instead of one came from WJ's behavior. Nonetheless, as more patients were added to the study pool, many began to show good control over both the ipsilateral arm and the contralateral arm. Yet even when patients had good control of the ipsilateral arm, good control over the ipsilateral hand seemed to elude them. Again, how did all of this work? Back to case DR. In the video, she was making hand gestures with both hands that appeared responsive to my verbal commands. I knew DR had split-brain surgery, and that her dominant language hemisphere was disconnected from the motor control systems of her right hemisphere. I was eager to learn how she was completing the task of controlling her left hand so easily, given that her two half-brains were disconnected from one another. What to do? Armed with this knowledge, I changed the exam ever so slightly, and this allowed the answer to emerge. Instead of asking DR to make a hitchhiker gesture with her right hand first, I asked her to make the gesture with her left hand first. She couldn't do it. After she failed, I then asked her to make it with her right hand, which she did instantly. Same story with the A-OK sign. She just couldn't do it if the left hand had to do it first. Why was that? Obviously, what was going on was that when the right hand, controlled by the left hemisphere, went first, it set up a model and an image for the right hemisphere to see and to copy. If a model was present to copy, then the right brain could mimic a gesture and perform that task easily. In essence, the patient had visually cross-cued the information from one hemisphere to the other outside of the brain, thereby trumping the fact that her brain-hemisphere connections had been severed. If this were true, then what would happen if the patient were asked to do the task with her eyes closed? With bedside testing, this was easily done. The exam continued. I asked the patient to close her eyes and to make a hitchhiker sign with her right hand, which again she instantly carried out. Now, with her eyes still closed, I asked her to make it with her left hand. Amazingly, she could not do it. The patient's right hemisphere could not understand the spoken command, and with her eyes closed, the left hemisphere could not cue the right hemisphere by providing the model gesture of the right hand to copy. As a consequence, the left hand sat there frozen with inaction. This one simple bedside test revealed so much. It revealed not only the dramatic disconnection effects of the surgery, but also a basic truth about goal-directed behavior. We are all eager to achieve singular, unitary goals, and we behave as we wish in specific circumstances. We somehow achieve this unitary output from a highly modularized brain with multiple decision centers. In human patients, when the normal neuronal pathways are disrupted, the goal may still be achieved through whatever alternate mechanisms and strategies remain available. In this instance, two things were clear. The right hemisphere, disconnected from the left, could not follow a verbal command, and it was the hemisphere with the major control over the left hand. The explanation might have been, however, that the left hemisphere could have governed the ipsilateral left hand through ipsilateral corticospinal pathways. A small number of neurons that are uncrossed, that we know exist. Yet we had already shown that that explanation could not be true, because the verbal command to gesture with the left hand could not be followed either when the eyes were closed or when the left hand was directed to respond before the right hand. What was going on? Clearly, the right hemisphere could only execute the command when it visually saw and imitated a model of the posture being requested. The overall system, with all of its separate modules, had cued itself into completing the goal. This cueing is a ubiquitous mechanism of goal-directed behavior. New cases, new findings. While these experiments on basic sensory motor control were booming along both at Caltech and in subsequent years at Dartmouth, I grew fascinated by the idea that we could show what a separated right, non-speaking hemisphere could do in terms of thinking, perceiving, understanding, planning, and all the rest. Getting anything out of W.J.'s right brain had proven difficult, even though he was clearly skilled at visual motor tasks such as the block design test. He responded normally and easily to the flash of a picture or word to his left hemisphere, yet flashing the exact same information to the right hemisphere generally provoked only minimal response. It was like pulling teeth. Driving to Downey every week in my old Studebaker was becoming a chore. Sometimes I went just to claim a $3.67 gas reimbursement, a rate that enabled me to run my car for the rest of the week. It wasn't until we began working with NG, a pleasant young woman with an exceptionally supportive husband, that we moved beyond the fundamental sensory-motor integration tasks we had studied so intensely in WJ. She, like WJ, had been operated on for uncontrollable epilepsy and treated by Bogan and his neurosurgical mentor, Philip Vogel. She was agreeable to testing and, as with most of the patients, it became a big part of her life. After all, here we were showering attention on the patients and compensating them for their time. We all built lasting relationships that have continued over the years. Just last spring, a relative of NG's husband called me after almost 45 years of no contact, just to say hello. Soon after NG came LB, a young boy of 12, another favorite and extensively studied patient. He had also been operated on to control his severe epileptic seizures. LB proved to be a remarkable case. Years later, again out of the blue, he sent me a yet unpublished manuscript he had written about his personal experience as a patient and experimental subject. In writing his personal perspective, LB had been assisted by Caltech's science writer, the wonderfully sensitive Graham Berry. These two new surgical cases brought real energy to the project. While they quickly confirmed the basic disconnection effects of WJ, they provided us with new insights about the function of the right hemisphere. Their right hemispheres responded to our tests with glee and vigor, even though their left hemispheres remained unaware of the content being processed by the disconnected and largely silent right hemisphere. By this time, I was using my Bolex camera a lot. When testing NG, I would place it on a tripod, pointing down in such a way that one could view not only the patient's face, but also objects placed out of view that the patient would sometimes have to touch as part of the test being run. In this way, it was easy to visualize the actual tests and the sometimes stunning results. First, objects held in the right hand could be easily named, but not those in the left hand. Second, pictures of objects flashed to the left hemisphere could enable the opposite right hand to find the matching object, but not the ipsilateral left hand. Third, and here was where the new era really began, pictures and even words flashed to the supposedly language-impoverished right hemisphere, triggered the left hand to retrieve the correct object out of view. It was astonishing, and remains so to this day. We were looking at the first real evidence that the right hemisphere could be capable of cognitive activity and complex behaviors without the left hemisphere knowing anything about it. After years of studying NG and LB, Sperry and I concluded that the right hemisphere had a large vocabulary. It could react correctly to printed words as well as to line drawings of all types. There was even some capacity in the right hemisphere for a simple spelling and an occasional written word, but rarely so. We pushed on in the hope of finding independent higher-level thought of some kind, and attempted several tests requiring simple arithmetic. Here we had an occasional success with simple addition, but none with subtraction. We were always on the lookout for brain functions that did transfer from one separated hemisphere to the other. After the monkey work with emotive stimuli, I wanted to see if humans would react in the same way. Would a potentially emotive stimulus cue the opposite hemisphere in some way, where it was clear that non-emotive stimuli did not? This test required a stop at the back of the magazine shop, where at that time, plain cardboard was placed in front of the risque magazine covers. Magazines would have to be bought and pictures clipped out, photographed, and then put into a slide carousel so they might suddenly appear in the left visual field as part of a sequence of pictures of more routine objects, such as spoons and coffee cups. I was nervous about this experiment. While I was a vigorous post-adolescent, to be sure, I was also a practicing Catholic, and as you well know, somehow I survived the guilt of producing the pictures and ran the test, first on NG. I had the camera all set up. It would catch any facial expression she might have, but since it was back in the silent film days, there would be no voice recording. Luckily, the film was clear and one could see her reacting to my questions. MSG. Fixate the dot. NG. Okay. A picture of a spoon was flashed to the left visual field, which revealed its contents solely to the right hemisphere. MSG. What did you see? NG. Nothing. Expressionless reaction on her face. MSG. Okay. Fixate the dot. This time a picture of a nude woman was presented to the right hemisphere. MSG. What did you see? NG. Nothing. But then she fights off a grin and finally lets it all out and does a full chuckle. MSG. Why are you laughing? NG. Oh, I don't know. That is a funny machine you have there. I was excited with this result, though it would be several years before I fully understood its implications. At the time, I simply wanted very much to confirm it with WJ. A few days later, I piled all my testing gear into my Studebaker and drove off to Downey. I flashed several neutral pictures to WJ before flashing the nude picture to the right hemisphere of this World War II veteran. Again, I asked, "What did you see?" With the most expressionless face I think I have ever seen, he replied, "Nothing." I was so disappointed. Maybe the test on NG was a fluke. To be complete, of course, I tested WJ's left talking hemisphere directly. To my surprise, and without expression of any kind, WJ said, "A pinup?" I said, "Yes." As I was fiddling around with my gear, WJ dryly added, "Is that the kind of co-ed you have at Caltech?" So there you go. Neither hemisphere found the nude engaging. Linus Pauling was right. Never assume anything. Leaving the nest. I took the phone call from Howard Kendler, the chair of UCSB Psychology Department, on the hallway phone in the Alice Laboratory at Caltech. Phones were not allowed in individual offices in Sperry's lab, and probably for good reason. When the phone rang, it was sort of an anti-signal. Answering it would invariably interrupt what you were doing. As it was, occasionally you still had to pick it up and then go fetch somebody. Phones were a pain in the neck. Nonetheless, it was my turn to take a call. I picked up and Howard said, "We would like to hire you as an assistant professor here at UCSB at the starting salary of $9,500 for 9 months." A 9-month offer meant you had to find your own salary for the other 3 months through grants or other means. As in the moment before a car crash, some vital issues flashed through my mind as he spoke. First, like it or not, it was time to leave Caltech. I had been there 5 years and new students were coming in to pick up the ball. Second, I had accepted a postdoctoral fellowship in Pisa to work with my dear friend Giovanni Berlucci. Third, I needed a job when I came back. And fourth, I would be within 100 miles of Caltech and close to the patients so I could continue research. Then and there, I heard myself saying, "I'll take it," and that was that. Of course, the decision was not without pain and a sense of loss. I had grown up into the ways of not only the scientific world, but also the social world at Caltech, which included political meanderings. My friendship with Bill Buckley had deepened, and in 1964, he invited me to be his sidekick at the Republican National Convention in San Francisco. The great American author John Dos Passos, who had become conservative after his flaming left-wing youth, was there to write an article on the convention for National Review. Bill gave me the assignment of shepherding him. One-eyed, in his 70s, Dos Passos had more energy than 6 young men. I could barely keep up. It was a sublime experience, capped off by the last night's chore of typing out his piece. It took me all night. The next afternoon, when I saw Bill, who had just been debating Gore Vidal, he calmly said to me, "Mike, I can see typing is not your strong card." Oh well, it wasn't. I was involved in other political functions at Caltech, including Martin Luther King Jr.'s final visit there in 1965. In the evening, he spoke at the historic Friendship Baptist Church in Old Town Pasadena. It was the first black Baptist church in the city. I was able to get into the back of the church for the sermon, which turned out to be one of the most moving experiences of my life. And there was more. Robert Kennedy came to Caltech in 1964, and writer James Baldwin came in 1963. Meeting such vibrant and driven public figures couldn't help but mature one's thinking about the social world. Baldwin, in particular, was moving. I had the honor of spending an evening in conversation with him in a smoke-filled den at the home of a Pasadena patron. He said that he had moved to Paris years before in order to feel more free as both an African-American and a homosexual. When asked why he returned to the States, he simply declared that even though Paris had many advantages, he was an American at the core. In the Small World department, a couple of years later, Baldwin and Buckley were in a much-reported debate at the Cambridge Union Debating Society in England. Baldwin was declared the winner.
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.